Good day, everyone. Welcome to the 19th Inside the Beltway Conference. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Kelly, and good morning to most of you all, but just barely good afternoon to those of you on the East Coast. I'm Fred Riche, and I'm chair of the Drinker Biddle Financial Services ERISA team, meaning the group that represents service providers, broker-dealers, insurance companies, mutual fund companies, RIAs, banks and trust companies, and so on, people that sell products and services or advise on products and services to plans. With me today is Jim Dolan, who is within that Texas fund, family of funds, and in a second I'll let Jim talk about that just a little bit. Also with me, literally from inside the Beltway, is Brad Campbell, who is a partner in our Washington, D.C. office. Brad, importantly for the discussion today, and in fact for all of our calls, is a former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration under the George W. Bush administration. And that is under the Obama administration, the group that issued the fiduciary regulation and the prohibited transaction exemptions. You all should know that today's call is being recorded. So if you call in with any questions at the end, you're going to be famous shortly thereafter. But more importantly, the recording will within a few days be posted on my law firm's website at www.drinkerbiddle.com. And there's a tab when you get to that page that's called Insights and Events, and that's the tab you would click on. Now, having said that, just to make this really easy on you all, we will be emailing everybody who registered for this call once the recording is posted, and you'll get a link to the posting. So if you forgot to write down what I just said about how to find it in a matter of days, certainly by the middle of next week, you'll be getting an email with that link. Having taken care of those housekeeping duties, let me turn it over to Jim Dolan. And Jim, before you start talking, I just want to let you know how much I appreciate your support and the support of NetTixis, which makes it possible for us to do this. You guys have just been great. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Fred. Thank you. And, we really do appreciate the partnership, and it's great to be able to provide this insight. This is our 19th presentation for Inside the Beltway, so it's really great. And just wanted to thank you, Drinker Biddle, Brad Campbell, for joining us, and for everyone who chose to call in today, thank you for choosing to dial in. And as Fred mentioned, I'm with Natixis Global Asset Management. We seek to serve thoughtful investment professionals worldwide through our durable portfolio construction approach. We apply risk-minded insights to empower more intelligent investing. We unite over 20 specialized investment managers globally, and we're ranked among the world's largest asset management firms. So it's really great to be able to continue this partnership. And again, thank you for calling in today. And with that, Fred, I'll turn it back to you.
Hey, Jim. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Let's jump, as I like to say, let's jump right into the weeds. I assume that most of you all want to know what's happening with the fiduciary rule. And so that's our first question. And to answer that question, let me turn it over to Brad, who is inside the Beltway and is talking with people in the Trump administration almost daily. Brad?
Well, thanks, Fred. Thanks, Jim. And, of course, most importantly, thanks to all of you for continuing to call in and hang with us for 19 of these quarterly calls. And welcome to the first one that's in the official Trump era. And to that end, as Fred said, the big question on everybody's minds is, whether the fiduciary rule. Is it going to be delayed? Is it going to be repealed? Is it going to be modified? And when will all of those things happen? Because, as we all know, the current applicability date is April 10th, coming up here rapidly upon us. And just a quick words about the process. So we know, for example, that the White House, through the Chief of Staff, put out a memo telling all of the agencies to go and review the regulations that have recently come out, to look at in the next, putting a 60-day freeze on them and looking at pulling them back. It's important that we start out by understanding that the DOL fiduciary rule itself is not something that can be just whisked away with a stroke of the pen. While that review may include looking at this rule, our understanding is the White House will likely send a separate memo specifically addressing the fiduciary rule. And the reason you would have it treated differently is that this rule actually went into effect last June as good law, so to speak, regulations on the books officially, even though its applicability date, the day we have to actually live with it, isn't until April. So this rule has to be modified or repealed or delayed largely through a notice and comment rulemaking. What we have been hearing is that this rule will likely be delayed in the very near future. We have literally been expecting potentially an announcement at any time. You know, this whole week, every day, we've been getting up and looking to see if this rule is going to be delayed. And the rumors that we're hearing, for what that's worth, is that the first action would be to delay the rule by about 6 months and then do a formal notice and comment for a longer delay, say of a year, and a notice and comment on potentially repealing the rule or modifying the rule and asking for comments on that. So the first step would be to delay the rule. The second step would be to determine whether to repeal, modify, where to go from there. And that first step, as I said, we've been anticipating coming out almost any day. That said, we don't actually know when it's coming out. The administration has a lot on its plate, a lot of priorities they're working through, and that anticipated memo from the White House, unless it's, you know, happened today as we're on the call or something, hasn't yet occurred. So we're waiting to see what's going to happen next on that, but at this point, our expectation is there will be a delay, and it will not go into be applicable on April 10th, but that hasn't actually happened yet.
And then, Brad, if you had the lay odds, and I know it's really impossible, but just at a gut level, you mentioned a delay and repeal or a delay and modify. Do you have any feelings of which of those is more likely?
Well, you know, from the kind of informal reactions that we're getting from people we've talked to, it sounds like right now there's a lot of interest in the Trump administration in looking more at a repeal approach. But it's important to note that as of right now, none of the people who will actually be the decision makers on this have been appointed and confirmed. You know, we have Mr. Puzder, the Labor Secretary nominee, as unless something came out today that I missed or yesterday, as really the only Labor Department official who's been nominated yet. We don't have any idea who will be running EBSA, who will be the Solicitor of Labor, all of those positions that would be relevant to making these decisions. And Mr. Puzder hasn't made any public statements one way or the other about his views on this rule. Now, other Trump administration officials have, and they've been very critical of the fiduciary rule. So we expect that it will be at a minimum modified and potentially repealed, but we really don't know the answer to that because we just don't know who the personnel are going to be making those final decisions.
Okay, and then, Brad, what are you telling your clients, I mean, in terms of what they should be doing right now?
Yeah, so very specifically, if you are in a position as broker-dealer, insurance agent, you know, whatever type of financial entity you are, where you are not currently a fiduciary, so April 10th is a pretty important deadline because that's when you anticipate having to become a fiduciary, there's a transition best interest contract exemption that will is much easier to comply with than the full best interest contract exemption, and that transition period runs from April 10th until the end of the year. Now, while we think it's quite likely that this rule will be formally delayed so that we won't need to go into the transition BIC, that's sort of, I think, plan B. That's where, rather than having full compliance ready to go, you can look at making some incremental changes to prepare for the possibility that the deadline might actually arise. So, for example, under the transition BIC, there are certain disclosures you need to make about your material conflicts of interest and about your fees, but you don't actually have to change the way you're receiving compensation. The conflicts that would be prohibited under the rule and that the full BIC exemption still requires you to modify the way you're paid, you're not required to modify that under the transition BIC. But what you do have to do is make fiduciary recommendations. You have to have a process to take into account all the relevant factors that's well documented. So that is a long-winded intro to your question, Fred, which is I've been advising clients to focus right now on whether what they would need to do to get a transition BIC disclosure in place, but also look at how are we modifying and how far along are we on modifying how advisors make and document recommendations. That fiduciary component would be in effect on April 10th if the rule is not delayed. And frankly, I think for a lot of our clients, when they start looking at FINRA compliance that they're expecting in the future and SEC enforcement actions they're expecting in the future, enhancing the process by which they make recommendations is probably going to be important and useful to do in any case, whether this rule goes forward or not. So I think that's time that our clients can feel is fairly well spent working on that process documentation around the recommendations. What are you telling your clients, Fred?
Well, no, you know, that's true on my end as well. I think everybody needs to be in a position to do their transition notices and disclosures. And in fact, we're drafting a lot of those right now. And as you said, that there's an effect the impartial conduct standards would apply. In the sense there can be no materially misleading statements, which I would think people would be doing anyway. Secondarily, you have to adhere to the best interest standard of care, which is essentially the fiduciary prudence standard of care. And then third, your compensation has to be reasonable. So I would like to see people, in addition to getting that transition notice ready to send out, that they would, because that's going to have to be sent out, you know, you would think maybe 6 weeks from now, so that it's out adequately before April 10th.
The deadline's coming up on us, and I think we've had a lot of clients who are really hoping they could get disclosures, if they need to be made, into some January statements. And unfortunately, the timing on this is not making it ideal to do that.
Exactly, and because that would hold down the cost a lot if they could include it in the January statements. Fortunately, those disclosures can be done electronically if your firm has, you know, if the firm of the people listening to us has email addresses for all of their retirement investors, then they could do it electronically. I would also say that since this is a prohibited transaction rule, the burden of proof of reasonable compensation is on the fiduciary advisor or the service provider. And so I would encourage people to be figuring out where they're going to get the data so that they know that the compensation of the advisor and the financial institution is reasonable. So that's the first thing. And we're still getting questions about grandfathering because that comes into play about the same time or at the same time. So yeah, there are questions here and there, but it seems to me the big effort is exactly what you said, which is get ready for the transition period, which can be done at a relatively nominal cost. But the problem is if you're not ready and you haven't set things up, then on April 10, you're out of business if the rule comes into effect, unless you're a pure level fee advisor. Were you going to add something, Brad?
Well, I was just going to suggest that we probably ought to go back and complete sort of the summary of where we are, because the DOL also, right at the end of the Obama administration, released a new proposed prohibited transaction exemption that's related to the BIC exemption, expanding the definition potentially of who's a financial institution for certain types of fixed annuities. And they also issued two more tranches of guidance. And so I think it's probably worth mentioning that all of those items would be subject to the Chief of Staff's memo that came out because, one, it does apply to guidance. So we don't know if DOL is going to, under the Trump administration, rescind those guidance documents, the FAQs that came out, or if they're going to leave them because ultimately they're only relevant to the extent the rule itself goes forward. And the exemption, and it's probably worth spending just a minute on describing what that exemption was. In the best interest contract exemption, a financial institution was defined as a bank, an insurance company, a broker-dealer, and a registered investment advisor. And if you were an independent insurance agent who was licensed only as an insurance agent, you found yourself in a situation where to sell, say, fixed index annuities or to advise on fixed index annuities, there wasn't really an obvious financial institution for you to use to have the BIC contract. To be the financial institution to execute a BIC contract, because fixed index annuities were moved out of 8424 into the BIC exemption. And I'm sorry, you were going to say something, Fred.
Yeah, on that, it's, I think the Department of Labor may have thought that the insurance companies would be the financial institution for all the agents that they had appointed. But when the insurance companies looked at that, they were willing to be the financial institution or have an affiliated broker-dealer be the financial institution for their captive agents and career agents. But for the truly independent agents, I think most insurance companies said that or felt that their relationship with the independent insurance agents wasn't close enough that they could realistically be co-fiduciaries. So that's where the system sort of fell apart. The role that I believe the Department of Labor thought that the insurance companies would play, they felt they could not prudently play. And so then you get back to, well, who's going to be their financial institution for the independent agents selling fixed index annuities? And back to you, Brad, because that's where your story picks up.
Absolutely, and so this issue was highlighted in some of the litigation against the fiduciary rule, pointing out that, in effect, it had foreclosed the ability of many insurance agents to go forward and advise on things like fixed index annuities. So DOL said in the final regulation, even though we're not letting anyone else be a financial institution, we will entertain individual exemption requests where someone can come and explain why they should be. And so what DOL calls insurance intermediaries, which are commonly known in the industry as IMOs, FMOs, marketing organizations of different, slightly different types, of 22 of them applied to the Department of Labor for individual exemptions. And we should probably disclose that we represented a number of those, so you understand to the extent we have bias that's why it's there. And DOL ultimately decided to propose a class exemption rather than individual exemptions. And what this class exemption proposal says is that if you meet these additional conditions on top of what are essentially the BIC exemption conditions already, then you as this insurance intermediary can act as a financial institution and enter into a BIC arrangement, thereby providing a means for this to occur. There is, I think, a lot of controversy over the conditions that they ultimately proposed. One of the big ones is that an entity wishing to be this type of financial institution would have to show that, on average, in each of the last three fiscal years, that they had sold more than $1.5 billion in premiums related to these annuities. There would also have to be insurance coverage or assets backing the entity, or a combination of the two, equal to 1% or more of those, or at least 1% of the premiums of each of the last 3 years. And there'd have to be financial auditing of the entity that would be made publicly available, along with a host of other conditions dealing with sort of the structure. Those were viewed, I think, by a number of folks as very onerous conditions, and so there's going to be one question then is, since this proposal has been put out at the second to last day of the Obama administration with a 30-day comment period, will that comment period be allowed to run by the Trump administration, or will they, under this Chief of Staff memo, either extend the comment period or pull back the proposal? With the view that potentially this issue is resolved in the broader context of the rule as a whole. Right now, we don't know the answer to that. So what we've been advising clients is we need to get ready to make comments, because as of right now, we're on a 30-day clock. Well, we're in the getting through the first quarter of a 30-day clock that's running on comments. And we haven't yet received any indication that the Trump administration is going to do something different. If I were to guess, I would imagine they will let the comment period run because this proposal doesn't tie their hands. They could come up with different conditions. They could use the comments to develop a very different final exemption or repropose a different class exemption, or they have a lot of discretion left. So I don't know that this is the kind of rule, so to speak, that they're worried about having put out there, because it doesn't prevent the Trump administration from doing what it wants to do on the issue ultimately. But that said, we have this question of, do we comment or not? And right now we have to take the position that we do need to comment, because the comment period is running.
Yeah, that's the way I see it too, Brad. And just to emphasize one thing that Brad said, was that this is a proposed exemption. It's not a final exemption. So as a proposed exemption, if the Department of Labor gets comments and the comment period ends, they have everything open to them. They could withdraw it because it's not final. They could open another comment period. They could have hearings. They could just delay the final until everything else gets resolved. So I agree with Brad that some of the conditions are so onerous that I think the department has shot itself in the foot by creating an exemption that's so narrow that it doesn't really meet the need of the marketplace. It is an unsuccessful exemption or proposed exemption. So something's going to have to change on it. But for the clients we represent, we've got to get those comments in so that when the appointees from the Trump administration are in place, they can look at those comments as a part of their decision of what to do about it. Brad, before we move on to the next subject, I just wanted to ask you, you mentioned quickly, I think, that the Department of Labor had issued some frequently asked questions, some Q&As. So they issued one set, I think, at the end of last year, and then they just issued their second set. On looking at the technical comments that they issued as opposed to the consumer education piece, what do you think about that? Do you think they were trying to be helpful? Do you think it's going to help your clients? What's your conclusion as you walk away from that?
Yeah, I have to say the FAQs that just came out were, I thought, more helpful than they were harmful, which is probably the opposite of the first tranche. So back at, I think it was the end of October, they put out FAQs on exemptions, and that raised actually a number of new problems and questions relating to advisor compensation and grids and agreements with advisors who are moving from one firm to another. That raised some new problems that had to be dealt with. These two most recent tranches of guidance, the consumer-directed one, I don't think did anything technically different. I viewed it more as sort of, I'll just use the word because I'm not a big fan of this rule, so I'll go ahead and call it a propaganda piece that was directed to consumers why this rule is so great and what consumers should ask, and sort of reiterated why DOL did this in the first place with the view that it's all good and in the consumer's interest. We could debate that another time. The second set of FAQs they put out here recently was we're on interpreting provisions of the rule itself. So the October guidance dealt with the exemptions. This guidance deals with the rule. And it actually had some rather helpful interpretations. One of the big ones that we've had questions from a lot of clients on is saying, well, look, we have wholesalers who go out into the marketplace and explain our products to advisors, third-party financial advisors. And under the fiduciary rule, when you're discussing these matters with a third-party financial advisor who is a fiduciary to one or more plans, it's not fiduciary advice. There's sort of an exclusion for these financial professionals affiliated with banks, broker-dealers, insurance companies, and RIAs. And the question has arisen, well, wait a minute, what if while the wholesaler is talking to that advisor, what if there's a plan committee member in the room? Someone from the plan who's listening to this conversation, does that convert this from a non-fiduciary conversation to a fiduciary one? And DOL actually gave useful guidance that said, no, just you are talking to the advisor and the presence of the plan fiduciary doesn't convert this to a fiduciary conversation. That's actually a pretty significant issue in the real world where advisors are called on all the time, or where wholesalers in particular are called on all the time to explain their products in various settings where there might be plan officials present. So this was actually a very helpful bit of guidance. Some of the other guidance was not as helpful. One, for example, specifically addressed what I've and others have been calling the source of funds issue. This is when, under the fiduciary rule, if I'm making a recommendation that would cause you to take a distribution and invest those proceeds in a certain way, and the example DOL used in the FAQ is an insurance agent is talking to a participant who has a required minimum distribution coming, and the insurance agent says, hey, you should take that RMD you're going to get and buy permanent life insurance, let's say for estate planning purposes. DOL took the position that that is fiduciary advice because the advice is being given while the assets are still in the plan. The fact that the RMD is mandatory and that the RMD is coming doesn't change that that's fiduciary advice when you tell them what to do with the proceeds. Telling them that there is an RMD and helping them calculate how much it is just education, but telling them how to invest the proceeds is advice. And there were just a number of Q&As that offered some sort of helpful provisions. for example, that an insurance annuity platform is a platform the same as a mutual funds-based platform. There are a variety of Q&As that were helpful. What were a couple of the others that jumped out at you, Fred?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I thought the wholesaler exception was extremely helpful. And there's a thing in the rule called independent fiduciaries with financial expertise, and that refers to the advisors. So the advisor to the plan, in Brad's hypothetical, is an independent fiduciary with financial expertise. And the DOL effectively said, well, when the wholesaler's in that meeting too, if the advisor is there, if the independent fiduciary with financial expertise is there, the department believes that the committee, the plan committee, for example, would turn to the advisor, the independent fiduciary with financial expertise, and ask the advisor, in so many words, rely on the advisor to help understand if the wholesaler is just touting their products or giving impartial advice. So it's the key is that the advisor be there and that the advisor be an independent fiduciary with financial expertise, which would include a representative of a bank or trust company, a representative of a RIA, a representative of a broker-dealer, for example. That could be an independent fiduciary with financial expertise. That one, I thought, was really important. It's going to help a lot. On the other hand, I agree with you. It's goofy that if you make a recommendation for somebody to take the proceeds of a required minimum distribution and invest it, let's say, in a life insurance policy the day before it's the money's distributed, that's fiduciary advice. If you wait till the day after it's distributed, that's not fiduciary advice. That is so artificial that it just doesn't make any sense at all. So I agree. That was the one I found the most problematic, at least conceptually. It bothered me a lot. Also, the platform, that's an open issue we'd worried about, whether or not a group annuity contract would be viewed as a platform such that an advisor could recommend it as a platform without becoming a fiduciary. Because if you're only a fiduciary if you recommend investment services, and so on. Recommending non-fiduciary services is not a fiduciary act. Another one that was helpful, it says, well, if a third-party administrator says to a plan sponsor, I think the ABC record keeper and the XYZ record keeper are good record keepers. By the way, they both pay me a subsidy, a payment. If you work with them and I'm your TPA on the plan, they both pay me money. The department said that's not a fiduciary recommendation. Recommending a record keeper is a non-fiduciary recommendation. Therefore, the fact that you receive the money is not a payment associated with a fiduciary recommendation. And since you fully disclosed it, you're not setting your own compensation by having hidden payments. That was the other one, I think, as I go through it, Brad, that sort of jumped out at me.
There's one last one I would mention, which is one of the other fiduciaries with financial expertise with whom you can have a non-fiduciary conversation is a fiduciary who manages $50 million or more in assets. And DOL expanded on that a little bit to clarify that those aren't just the assets of the individual plan that you might be discussing with them. it could include the assets of all ERISA plans. They also gave an example of, you know, the particular fiduciary is CFO of the company and manages $10 million in liquid investments of the company's money, that could count as well to the $50 million total. So it doesn't have to be linked just to ERISA. And this cuts both ways if this rule were to actually, you know, go forward and be put into effect. It cuts both ways because, on the one hand, there's many occasions where advisors might want to have the $50 million figure be easier to reach so that you can be dealing potentially on a non-fiduciary basis with this person. On the other hand, the BIC exemption is not available for a $50 million plus fiduciary. So if you're a fiduciary who needs the BIC exemption to be able to give advice, and if the client doesn't want anyone who has any conflicts, and they're not eligible for the BIC exemption, you could be in a situation where you may not be able to readily provide advice to that client because you're not a pure fiduciary and you can't use the BIC exemption because they're a $50 million plus fiduciary you're talking to. So this could cut both ways, and I think there's still a lot of practical questions about how you would calculate this $50 million and assure yourself of it as an advisor when you're using it. So that was a clarification beyond the rule on an important issue, but I think there's still a lot more clarification that would be useful.
Yeah, one of the oddities about that, they said, however, that same CFO, if you're advising him on his own IRA, even though he manages more than $50 million, he's not an independent fiduciary for his own IRA, and therefore you don't have that independent fiduciary exception or carve-out. Another goofy result.
Somehow he's able to manage the assets of hundreds or thousands of other people, but not his own. It's kind of a weird rule.
It strikes you as nonsensical. Before we move on to what Congress is up to and how it's going to impact plans, I think one last thing I want to mention, going back to the beginning, where should people be paying attention? I would say recommending rollovers. The plan distributions and rollovers is another area, because even if the rule goes away, there's still FINRA Regulatory Notice 13-45 that would govern the conduct of broker-dealer representatives that has a fiduciary-like component to it. And it says that a recommendation, among other things, it says that a recommendation to take a distribution is a recommendation to liquidate your investments in the plan. That's a securities recommendation, therefore it has to be suitable. But at some level, how can you make a suitable recommendation if you don't even know the investments, expenses, and services that the participant is using in the plan? I mean, there's a bit of an imponderable there. Also, under a 2005 advisory opinion, if you're already a fiduciary to a plan and you make a recommendation to roll over, you're a fiduciary for purposes of making that recommendation, independent of the new rules. So that whole rollover area is something you need to pay attention to now because of the other guidance that's out there. And it's also something that, you know, with 10,000 people retiring a day now, more or less, and most of them rolling over to IRAs, and many of them older, you know, 65, 70 years old, it's inconceivable to me that that area does not become more regulated. I mean, it's just a huge issue that hasn't been dealt with effectively in the past, and something's going to break on that. For example, the SEC and their examinations now is looking at that as well, both for their examinations related to older investors and their examinations about retirement plans. So for a whole bunch of reasons, really think about your strategy for capturing rollovers.
I would just add to that very quickly. Again, going back to that 2005 advisory opinion that Fred referenced, in that same opinion, DOL refused to say and, in effect, created a gray area about whether, if you're a fiduciary to a plan and you're now handling the rollover, whether that's a prohibited transaction. The rule would solve that by making all rollover advice, in effect, prohibited transactions needing an exemption. But if that rule were to be delayed so that it's not going to effect or repealed, I still think there's a mess here that needs to be cleaned up by the Trump administration to clarify some of these rollover issues whether that's through modifying the rule or doing a separate exemption. But Fred's absolutely right. The rollover area still has some potholes, or what do you want to call potential problem areas that you need to be aware of as you're going forward.
Hey, Brad, let's go back to inside the Beltway. And let's talk about it in two segments. The first one is, what do you think is going on with Congress? What kind of proposals do you think we're going to see? Where do you think there's some possibility of getting legislation that will impact retirement plans? And then the second one is, moving away from Congress, what about the Trump administration? But start with Congress.
Well, starting with Congress, there is actually congressional interest in doing legislation on the fiduciary rule and defining fiduciary advice and dealing with the prohibited transaction issues and exemptions. And so we'll probably see legislation at least based on, although probably slightly different than, legislation we saw in the last Congress on the fiduciary rule. We've already seen legislation that would call for a two-year delay of the rule, and we're probably going to see legislation that's based on the SAVERS Act and the acronym of the other version of that bill, ARRAPA, which I have now forgotten what the acronym stands for, but legislation reintroduced to look at creating a legislative definition. So if DOL, for example, repeals the rule, we may see Congress step in and create a new rule. Or if DOL modifies it, maybe that blunts congressional action. But there is congressional interest in the fiduciary rule as a legislative issue as well. There's also questions and legislation potentially to be introduced in Congress that could address this from the securities side and, you know, make this something the SEC gets more involved in and tries to steer it through that direction. So there's a potential tax ERISA avenue in Congress for the fiduciary issue. There's also a securities avenue for this in Congress, and we'll have to see how that legislation plays out. I suspect part of that will depend on what the Trump administration does with the rule. On other issues, tax reform is probably the biggest game in town for all sorts of reasons. I mean, we haven't pruned the tax code since 1986, so there's, you know, a lot of need for comprehensive tax reform. But there's also a lot of risk in the sense of how this might materially change the taxation of retirement plans. Retirement plans are the number two tax expenditure, that is, things Congress doesn't tax that it ordinarily would, and they keep track of how much they're not collecting on things they've decided not to tax. And for retirement benefits, that's roughly $1.5 trillion over 10 years, which even in Washington is real money. So there's a risk that in the course of doing tax reform, especially if they're trying to achieve a revenue-neutral version of tax reform, that we might see changes or are likely even to see changes in tax treatment of retirement plans to generate some revenue. Those could take a lot of different forms, some benign, some actually potentially very harmful to the formation of plans and the system as we know it. So we're going to have to keep a close eye on that debate and work with Congress as that goes through to make sure they understand which changes hurt the system potentially and which don't. But that's an area we really need to keep our eye on.
Do you think we might see cutbacks in limiting the amount that can go into a 401k plan or requiring that some deferrals over a certain percentage be Roth deferrals? What about ideas like that?
I think all of those are on the table. There have been, you know, bipartisan commissions put in place in the past to look at how to reform the tax code, and they've suggested things like capping overall deductions and exclusions, and there have been proposals on this issue put out by Republicans and Democrats in the past. You know, there was a proposal from the former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Mr. Camp, a few years ago that would say the first half of your 401k contributions are pre-tax, the second half are Roth only. So there's a lot of different ways that this could go into effect, a lot of different ways to change the tax treatment. That could include means testing so that higher comp employees don't get the exclusion but might still get the inside buildup tax-free. I mean, there's just a lot of different proposals on the table. I think we need to view them as really sort of almost all of them open to discussion. I've not heard anyone in Congress come forward and say, you know, this or that area is just something we're not going to do. Instead, what they've been offering are different ways to go about doing it with a general agreement that they need to move forward. So again, I think the watchword here is watching Congress and being very flexible in responding to where the proposals are, so that when the final decisions are made, they're not made out of sort of any ignorance about the potential outcomes of those changes.
Brad, I'm reminded of an old saying, which is there are two things that children should never see, how legislation and sausage are made.
I was just going to say, we only have to look at the code currently and see that, you know, your RMDs and all this are triggered off of being half a year old, you know, 59 and a half, 70 and a half, to realize that there's no logic behind some of these compromises that happen at the 11th hour.
Well, let's move on to what about the Trump administration, either through the Department of Labor or other administrative agencies, or even perhaps, if you haven't hit on it already, legislative proposals. But what do you see happening there?
Well, obviously, the Trump administration is going to be a big player in this tax debate as well. So one of the things I think we're all going to have to wait and see is exactly how they treat retirement plans in the tax portions of, say, their budget submissions and tax reform. In terms of the Labor Department, one of the things, and I'm not sure how much this will impact everyone on this call, but one of the things I think we're very likely to see the Labor Department address early on is repealing and replacing some interpretive bulletins that the Obama administration issued. One is on economic, social, other factors, sort of non-economic factors, but more sort of political or social justice factors to consider in making investments, and whether those are permissible under the ERISA fiduciary standard. Again, in the interest of full disclosure, while I was running the agency, we put out an interpretive bulletin that said those can only be tiebreakers where all the other economic factors are the same. The Obama administration basically said, no, those can be valid factors in the initial analysis. I think the Trump administration will act to restore it to much more what we were talking about in the Bush administration. Similarly, there's an interpretive bulletin on shareholder activism and how much pension plans can get involved in and analyze the benefits and costs of getting involved in proxy issues and other shareholder type activities. And in the Bush administration, our view on that was the numbers had to justify the cost and expense of being involved. That was made easier in a recent interpretive bulletin for pension plans to get involved. And there's some real political overtones behind what's going on there, in particular corporate campaigns sponsored by unions and others. So those are some areas where I think we'll see change probably in the near term coming from the Labor Department.
Brad, under the Obama administration, before the fiduciary rule sucked the oxygen out of the room, they were working on guidance on the projection of how much retirement income a participant's pattern of behavior, say in a 401k plan, would produce. If you took that and projected it, where would they be? Do you think there's any possible activity on reviving that and requiring that participants be given projections of income?
Well, that issue is one that conceptually sounds easy and makes a lot of sense. How can you at a glance give a person an idea of whether they're on the right path or not, whether they need to save more to get to where they want to be? But technically, it's really quite difficult to do a regulation that is going to handle those issues properly. You have just a lot of issues about what methodologies are used, how accurate are the estimates, what's the liability of the plan or the liability of the financial institution making those projections. Is a safe harbor by regulation, which is kind of where DOL was going in its proposal, should that be basically something that's easy to comply with and therefore very prescriptive in how you do it, or something that's very open and principles-based to allow all the different ways that people are currently making such projections, and that has implications on how easy it is to comply with. My guess is that DOL, while it isn't opposed to the notion, found in response to its proposal and the comments it received that this is a technically very challenging regulation to do, and I would be surprised if they lead off with that in the Trump administration. I think, in fact, it's more likely that Congress will throw some provision requiring some sort of number In tax reform, a number of the congressional bills dealing with retirement reform have had a version of this concept. So I think it might end up being that Congress leads the way on this, and then DOL down the road does a regulation to implement the congressional standard and sort of delays action on it. But that's a guess. So, I mean, again, we don't know really what the Trump administration priorities are going to be at this level, you know, reg by reg, because we don't have the personnel in place yet to really make those decisions.
We got a couple of questions in advance, Brad, and let me go over them, and then after we've answered those, we'll open it up to questions more generally. One question says, I'm an RIA and a licensed insurance agent, and I sell fixed indexed annuities and non-registered variable annuities in the 401k marketplace. As a dual licensed practitioner, I'd like to know what changes I should make to my practice to comply. I think we've already talked a little bit about, for fixed indexed annuities, you need to have a financial institution. For variable annuities, also if you're receiving commissions on either one, you need to have a financial institution. Now, an RIA, the entity, the firm, can be a financial institution, but that means you need to be under the best interest contract exemption, and there are a bunch of requirements, a website, a contract, disclosures, on and on, very expensive. What we're seeing is that some insurance companies are creating annuities that can be advised. For example, if you're working with a retirement investor, and you think that 25% of their assets should be an annuity, of either a fixed index annuity or a variable annuity, where you can actually include that in the portfolio, charge, let's say hypothetically, a 1% fee on all assets in the portfolio, and the insurance companies will pay you your 1% each year or your quarter of a percent each quarter in order to have it work as a part of a, you know, say the fixed, the equivalent of a fixed income allocation within the investor's portfolio. I think it would be extraordinarily difficult for a small RIA, and I'm not saying you're small, I'm just thinking out loud, for a small RIA to absorb the expense of compliance with full BIS. And what do you think, Brad?
I think ultimately that there's probably a lot of truth to that. I think some small RIAs might be able to make that work because their conflicts are relatively simplified. So, it would be a challenge, but it isn't necessarily one that's insurmountable. But I think it raises a broader point, which is from the perspective of advisors, regardless of what type of advisor you are, whether you're an insurance agent, a registered rep, an IAR, a consultant. At the end of the day, if you have to use something like the BIC exemption because you're getting commission or you're recommending proprietary products or products of an affiliate or all of the other ways of traditional compensation that this rule generally prohibits, then a lot of these decisions are in the hands of the financial institution with which you're affiliated. And so one of the things I think a lot of advisors have found frustrating, but is just a reality of compliance with this regulation as it was put out, is that the financial institutions have to make the decisions about how they're going to proceed and what they're going to enable you to do. So one of the first things you need to be doing is checking in with your financial institution and finding out where they are and what they've decided to do. And the reality with the new Trump administration and the potential for delay of this rule is that announcements that probably would otherwise have been made probably have not been made. So we're all kind of in a bit of a state of flux waiting to see how this rule is going to go down. But for advisors, a lot of this is going to be determined for you by your financial institution.
Yeah, and I think based on the work I'm doing with different financial institutions, there is clearly this has accelerated the trend towards level fee advice. I think we're going to see a lot more financial institutions, broker-dealers primarily, having more and more level fee services advising accounts. So there is an impact. There's a practical impact beyond the legal issues that we're discussing. Brad, another question is, and we've halfway addressed it, but but maybe you could add a little bit. What are financial institutions expected to do if the DOL fiduciary rule is delayed by the new administration?
Well, first of all, let's see how long the delay is. If the delay is substantive, you know, if it ends up being a year delay, that really changes the character of what institutions need to do. If for some reason the delay were very short, say 60 days, that would put a whole different character on it. You know, very short delay may not help people much in terms of how much they have to push on the gas to get to compliance. Whereas a one-year delay really does change the decision-making process for those institutions. So assuming it is a long delay, which is, you know, longish, roughly, say, a year, which is what we are hearing is likely to happen, again, though we can't be sure until it does, I think that will cause financial institutions to really look at intermediate measures rather than continuing towards full compliance, on the assumption that there's going to be substantive changes made and that year period is being used to do it. So yeah, I think there have been a number of institutions that have announced some decisions they'd already made, and I would be, my pure guess is that probably a lot of those won't change, but we'll see what happens unless the rule goes a very different direction. But I think this is a long-winded, rambling way of saying I think it all really depends. If there's a long delay, I think financial institutions will probably slow down their compliance efforts substantially, trying to figure out what's coming next and have discussions with the Trump administration, which right now we can't really have because, again, they don't have all the people in place. But when they do have the people in place, it'll be a much more useful and robust discussion with the regulators to find out what their plans are.
Yeah, and just picking up on what Brad said, I think some of the decisions that have been made, like to move more and more to level fee advice, I think those are baked in the cake. I mean, I think it's beyond a compliance issue now. I think that's a business model, and the decisions are, in some cases, they're permanent. That's what they're going to do, regardless of whether we have a rule or not. I think you're going to see more activity in the rollover area as well, regardless of what happens under the rules. But yeah, if it's a year, I think it's very hard for a financial institution to keep preparing for a rule that you don't even know what it's going to say. And I do think that I wouldn't be surprised if the Trump administration, after getting a delay of a year, were to decide in the first 5 or 6 months and announce what they were going to do, if they were going to repeal it so that everybody could stop working on it, or if they were going to modify it. I think they might even extend the period further so that there would be a modification, but then like another year or more to for an applicability date. So we'll have to see. Those are logical outcomes, logical conclusions, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, you know, one wild card we haven't mentioned here, which we should remind people is still out there, is that there is still litigation ongoing against this rule. And there's at least one federal court that has not yet ruled on the basic question of whether this rule should be stayed while the underlying case against it is heard. So at any time also hanging out there is the potential for federal courts to intervene in this process. So just adding yet another layer of uncertainty as to, you know, how long and where and how and when.
There you go. Kelly, why don't we open it up for questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you do have a question, that will be star one. A voice prompt will indicate once your line has been open, and we do ask that you state your name before posing your question. And again, star one for questions. And we'll take our first caller. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Fred and Brad. First of all, thank you very much for having these talks. My name is Michael Viljak with NFP. And my question pertains to some sort of incongruity which I think is embedded in the fiduciary rule for plan sponsors, where they, by implication, have the responsibility for monitoring record keepers' customer support lines so that they determine if a customer support person may go over the line between providing education and providing advice and how impossible that responsibility might be. Do you have any comments on that?
Brad, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, well, I'll start out with saying yes. I think there have been people who are raising a lot of concerns about, okay, so this has changed how the financial service providers need to operate, but what does this mean for plans? And there are some cases where DOL said very specifically, for example, on educational programs, the DOL said in the preamble that they would expect that prudent fiduciaries would review these educational programs to see if they're basically doing what they intend them to do or whether they're providing fiduciary advice. They weren't quite that clear in the preamble about the issue you raised. And what I would say is, as a plan sponsor, I would like my contract with that record keeper to very clearly state that those call centers will not be providing advice. You know, very clearly lay out why they're not going to be fiduciaries and that they will provide education and have that all laid out. So I have warranties and representations in my contract that I can rely on. I don't think it's true, though, that it automatically creates an ongoing monitoring obligation where you would need to worry about, you know, a particular advisor and a particular answer person, let's say in a particular call center, giving advice in contravention of the record keeper's policies. But I do think it would be prudent for the plan fiduciary, the responsible plan fiduciary hiring and creating that engagement, to have reviewed that issue with them and have that be part of the record in their decision about whether to hire that service provider. I don't know. What do you think, Fred?
Well, you know, there's the general obligation to prudently select and monitor service providers. I think the open question is how far does that go as to each function that the service provider provides for the plan, and certainly the call center is one of the services that record keepers provide for plans. So it is I agree with Brad. I think you really ought to have something in your contract saying that you know, the call center will provide, education and information that is complete and unbiased, but they will not provide fiduciary advice on investments, distributions, or otherwise. If the call center wants to be a fiduciary for those purposes, then work out with them how they're going to, under the committee, the plan committee should understand how they're going to do it prudently and how they're going to avoid conflicts of interest. In terms of, ongoing monitoring, it's hard to know. I mean, both with the prudent process to select the call center to provide services to the plan, as a part of the record keeper function and the monitoring of it, it's somewhat difficult to answer that because the general rule for all of this is you have to engage in a prudent process. And then the question becomes, what does a prudent process include? Well, we know from other guidance by the Department of Labor, if you ever get a complaint from an employee, then, there's a duty to investigate or at least to consider the complaint and take appropriate steps, which ordinarily would include a duty to investigate. So there aren't any real specific guidelines, but if you were a fiduciary and your job was to act in the best interest of the participants, what would you do to make sure that they're not being provided with biased advice that might favor the proprietary products affiliated with the record keeper or might biased advice that would perhaps favor investment and recommending that the participants invest in things that pay more revenue sharing. There aren't any guidelines, so we have to make it up. And with individual clients, I've done that, and I've helped some record keepers with their systems. And most record keepers have pretty robust systems, so I would want to know what those systems are. And then if you don't get any complaints, at the very least, periodically, maybe every few years, inquire as to whether those are current or whether they've changed their systems. But there's some duty there. We just don't. There's no cases, no guidance, no nothing to tell us how far you have to go.
Yeah. Well, just to clarify two things. One, my point was I don't think there's inherent in that monitoring obligation a duty to say affirmatively audit on a regular basis specific calls, to try and get copies of the tapes to listen to them or that sort of obligation. I think that's where it's probably going farther than anyone would expect. And I think the kind of measures Fred described would be reasonable ones in lieu of those. The other thing is there's nothing inherently wrong with your record keeper going beyond that. And so beyond the call center making referrals, for example, for participants who might want to talk about rollovers, but you need to know how that's going to occur, whether that's going to occur. That's something you need to make sure you understand. But I just want to reiterate to folks that that doesn't mean it's prohibited. It just means it has to be done the right way, and you want to know as a plan fiduciary whether it's happening.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator?
We'll take our next caller. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Fred and Brad. Stephen Force with Pioneer Investments.
How you doing? Hey,
wonderful, thank you. When you were reviewing the FAQs, I wanted to know if you could speak to the FAQ number 2, specifically question 7. Does that not confirm the Frost Bank advisory in using revenue-sharing payments to offset fees to avoid a PT, and therefore not having to use BICE? And I would like to get your comments on that.
Go ahead, Brad.
Well, no, go ahead, Fred.
Well, yeah, no, it does. It definitely confirms the offset method in Frost Bank and also in the Country Trust Advisor opinion. I found it a little odd because there's actually a footnote in the preamble to, I guess, BICE that where the DOL has already said that. But they must have been getting enough inquiries, or it's only people like me who are really anal that read the footnotes. But they felt they needed to come back and say it again. I think the remaining issue there, and I've heard a couple of people discuss this, and also struck me that way, is I wish the department had come out and said, oh, yeah, and also if you follow that method, you're entitled to use the BICE light or level fee fiduciary approach to recommending rollovers. But that's still out there as a gray area. I don't know, Brad, do you have some insights on that?
Yeah, I agree. I wish they had clarified that as well, because in my view, you should be able to use the two in combination, because what the advisory, Frost Bank advisory opinion says is there is no prohibited transaction if you're doing this offsetting, and therefore there shouldn't be a need for an exemption related to that portion, so that ought to make things work for the BICE light or BIC light or level fee option exemption. But we have DOL in other guidance, in the exemption guidance from late October, taking a very narrow view of that exemption, saying you couldn't use commissions or revenue sharing or any other form of payment like that to get to level compensation. So there is still a question there. You know, hopefully this is the kind of thing that we won't have to worry about as the Trump administration resolves this one way or another. But, you know, I guess I'd go back to what I said about the FAQs that came out. There was some helpful information in there, but there's still a lot of big gaps, holes, and questions that we wish we had better answers to.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Stephen. Operator, we'll take one more question, and then we have to wrap it up.
Again, that is star one for any further questions at this time. No other questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Kelly. Well, you know, I want to thank everybody for being here today, and let me turn it over to Jim to let you know when the next one's going to be and what to expect. Jim, back to you.
Thanks so much, Fred. Great call today. And Brad, thanks for dialing in. And thank you to Drinker Biddle for the partnership on our 19th call here. Again, thank you to everyone who was able to take the time and join us today. There will be an email that comes out with the replay of this call. And please mark your calendars for April 25th. That will be our 20th session of Inside the Beltway. And operator, you're welcome to close out the call. Thank you.
Thank you again, everyone. That will conclude today's conference. Thank you all for joining us.